now, 92.9 FM ESPN presents Memphis's biggest columnist.
You ain't got to do nothing, homeboy. You ain't writing nothing. No, you ain't writing nothing. I ain't letting him write. He ain't getting no interviews.
It's the award-winning Jeff Calkins from the Daily Memphian and the Jeff Calkins Show.
I don't get no interview.
On 92.9 FM, ESPN.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is something they call a groundbreaker. So let me first apologize to the shirts and the ties for your makeup. Cause I make you ugly. As soon as it drops, we're on a rampage. Bubbles popping up before you know it. There's rubble in the dust, cause we'll be pushing it up. Somebody say, you better run. Yeah. I think it's an earthquake. Up in here. Straight up. I think it's an earthquake. Up in here.
Let's see. Oh, today on the radio show, busy day today because we got fish on Friday on Tuesday because it is Tuesday. But before that, Jennifer Chandler's going to join us. Jennifer Chandler writes about food for the Daily Memphian, does a terrific job. It's interesting to me how when you're writing about food, you would think, and let's be honest, we love food. We love eating food. We love talking about food. We love ranking food. We love restaurants. We love restaurant people. We love food. But when you're writing about food, so often you're writing about, like, real life and stuff and whatever. So, like, Jennifer Chandler, in addition to recently, she published a recipe for the barbecue shrimp at Kelly English's barbecue, Kelly English's barbecue shrimp, which is sensational. It's a simplified recipe because evidently the real recipe takes, you know, days and days and days. But so much now is writing about restaurants is writing about the economy. It's writing about inflation. It's writing about crime and safety. It's writing about all of those things. You just think about, I mean, you know, last week when the Blind Bear is the most recent to announce that it is closing, but many others have. Jennifer did a really interesting piece last week where she broke down the cost of a dish at a restaurant. Do you know, Jeffrey, do you have a sense of what percent, the industry standard, what percent of what you order is typically food cost? In other words, they pay for the meat, the eggs, the vegetables, whatever, before you think about the labor, you know, the servers, the rent, the insurance, the, like, everything else, the candles, the what, like, everything else. What percent do you think is the food cost of a typical dish?
Probably half, right?
30%.
Yeah.
Is the industry standard should be. If you're going to make a living as a restaurant person, your food cost should be around 30%. Because there's a lot of other things you have to pay for. She wrote about the sea bass at Tsunami, which is unbelievably great. And Ben Smith, who's the owner at Tsunami, he can't take it off the menu because it brings people in. Like, people love the sea bass at Tsunami. But basically, not worth it for him to make it now because the food for sea bass,
right,
the food cost is so high. For 8 ounces of sea bass, he paid the other day $19. Well, when you're starting out with that, you know, you're going to have to price the sea bass so high that people don't, you know, it's a complicated math question.
And I would also imagine, like, the ordering process becomes complicated because you're like, well, you don't want to get left with too much.
Right.
You don't, you know what I mean?
Well, and sometimes you take so sometimes she had examples of Jim's place. They took, they had to take, they you, sometimes the prices get so ridiculous because the underlying prices get so ridiculous that they just take the thing off the menu.
Right, because you don't want to put a $50 item.
You don't put $62 dip on the menu or whatever. I've noticed that with scallops.
Oh, yeah.
And I honestly noticed it with Bounty, which I used to, Bounty closed. I did used to do spots for Bounty. I don't think there's a correlation there. I hope we helped Bounty for many years. Spread the word about Bounty. Loved Bounty. But I will say that at the height of some of this stuff, I ordered the scallops at Bounty. And I don't, it may have been one scallop. You know, it may have been one scallop. It was like, and it like, if you're going to only give me one, if you have to cross out the S on the menu for scallops.
Yeah, when it becomes singular.
Take it off the menu until scallops are affordable again, right? I mean, I don't know how to do this. They knew how to do this. It's an incredibly complicated deal. Anyway, sure, she writes about the joy of food. She wrote about the struggles with food. And we're going to have Jennifer in the Chris Harrington slot straight up at 10 o'clock. So that'll be fun. Jennifer Chandler, straight up at 10 o'clock. Charles Fishman, Fish on Friday, on Tuesday, after that. In the next segment, Jeffrey, I am outraged. Outraged. I am outraged by a whole series of things. I don't like seeing other people be happy. I am so outraged by a whole series of things. One of them involving the Grizzlies. One of them involving the Olympics. One of them involving Little League. I am...
That's rank.
I find myself in a state of outrage.
But none of it is the Bills?
Not really outraged about the Bills. Even their pathetic performance the other day. Because I have, and this is something I got from a Buffalo radio host.
You've taken the preseason pledge?
I've taken the preseason pledge.
Well, Aaliyah did not take the preseason pledge. And I had to, like, calm her down.
I was in Buffalo for my high school reunion, and so I even briefly thought about going over.
Because
you can get in for $25 and like whatever, and some of my classmates did, and Josh played a little bit, and Caleb Williams played, and whatever else. I'm so glad I didn't go to that game. Caleb Williams looked good, but I've taken the preseason pledge, which is put no stock in the preseason. Remember last year, the Pittsburgh Steelers and that offense?
Well, they always look good in preseason.
I mean, they were going to, Kenny was going to light it up. This was going to be the year. Believe they got new quarterbacks in there this year, right?
They have two of them.
Mind you, they did scrape into the playoffs, so they got demolished. But so I've taken the preseason pledge and to not put any stock in preseason. I do worry about my Bills, not because particularly of what I saw this past weekend. But I am outraged about a whole variety of things. Again, one having to do with the Grizzlies, one having to do with the Olympics, one having to do with Little League. And I'll see, Jeffrey, if you share my outrage. Before that, a couple things. Didn't want another moment to go past before I recognize that it is... The early word let me down today. Early word, of course, is the email from the Daily Memphian. Terrific. Terrific. Best way to start the day. Well, a cup of coffee in the early word.
Why not both?
There, Bianca... wrote that it is National Prosecco Day.
Yes.
Of all the uninspired days, maybe I don't have the appropriate reference.
Well, it's also my wife's birthday, and those kind of go hand in hand.
Well, I can see that then. It's also international, which, let's be honest, tops national. It is International Left-Handers Day, Jeff. Mm-hmm. And so... So we're gonna play a brief game, okay? And I want to commend you because you had no idea I was gonna do this, and I would not allow you to do this to me.
No, of course not.
I would not allow you to do this to me. But you've got a show in the afternoon
exactly.
That you can run how you damn well please,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so here is the question.
It's how the business works.
I will name two people.
I have to tell you the lefty.
Or maybe it's both.
Okay. But it can't be neither.
It can't be neither.
So at least one person of these two is left-handed.
Is a lefty. Okay. Yeah. Okay, ready? Barack Obama or George W. Bush?
Barack.
Barack is correct. George Harrison or Paul McCartney?
Paul McCartney.
You're right. Paul McCartney, lefty.
They both play. You've given me so far. So I know W swings a club right-handed, and I also I've seen him throw a baseball. With Obama, I've seen him shoot a basketball.
Eric Clapton or Jimi Hendrix?
Hendrix.
God.
You've given me instruments. Like you've given me instruments. This helps.
Okay, fine.
Please keep going in the order.
Is a laptop lefty or righty?
No.
Is an iPhone lefty or righty?
Well, the left-handers would complain that it's that they're that all
is a computer
things.
Program. Steve Ballmer or Bill Gates?
Ooh, Ballmer.
Ding ding! No! Bill Gates is the lefty. Phew. Ted Williams or Babe Ruth?
Babe.
Both.
Ah.
Both. You forgot the both option. Prince Harry or Prince William?
Prince William.
Prince William is the lefty. Very
so
nice.
Sad. God, that's sad.
Tom Cruise or Michael J. Fox?
Michael J. Fox.
No, Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise lefty. Aristotle or Napoleon?
I don't know if my guy's left-handed. I'm going to say Aristotle.
Both. You can look it up, man.
I'm not pushed back on any of these.
Okay. Boomer Esiason or Michael Vick?
Both.
Both. Very good. Very good. Couldn't fool you there. Oprah or Eddie Murphy?
Oprah.
Oprah is left-handed. I don't know how many you've done, but you've done very well here. And that concludes our game. It turns out, you know, roughly 10% of the country is left-handed. And what's interesting is I was thinking about...
Well, you've forgotten one of the greatest left-handers of all time. LeBron. So at the end of every Team USA practice, they would do a free throw shooting drill.
Uh-huh.
And you had to shoot with your opposite hand.
Oh.
And LeBron shot right-handed, won the drill, crowned himself... Because he claims, I'm naturally left-handed. I do everything left-handed. Shooting right-handed is...
So, leaving LeBron aside, I was looking at some of the great left-handed athletes, right? And honestly, I think you can argue that Babe is the greatest of all. Right?
Probably. I mean, there's always the issue with baseball of... pre-integration, whatnot. But yes, he's certainly the most accomplished, probably.
Others who were lefty, Martina Navratilova.
Yeah.
Actually, tennis is pretty rich in lefties, and that's no accident. 40% of seeded players in tennis are lefty.
Yeah, because you don't see this. It's a different spin and everything.
Martina Nadal is lefty. McEnroe was lefty. Connors was lefty. All those dudes lefty.
Yeah.
Like that's, I'm just, you know. So James Harden, lefty. Koufax, obviously lefty. Phil Mickelson, of course, lefty.
Right-handed swings lefty.
Maradona, lefty. What's interesting is there really are not. So some sports you have being left-handed is considered an advantage, right?
Yep.
So... honestly, in baseball...
left-handed and breathing.
39% of the hitters are lefties, and 28% of the pitchers are lefties, and only 10% of the country's lefties. You are better off if you are lefty.
Yes.
It's just true. 15 of the top 20 career batting averages, lefty.
Yeah.
Now, you've got some advantages. You've got a shorter run to first. You've got momentum carrying you to first. Like...
yeah, but the biggest advantage is you get to see the ball coming from the other direction.
But there's a series of advantages.
Correct.
There's others. So you're better off if you're a baseball player. Fencing, half of the fencers in the world are lefties.
Yeah.
And only 10%
high
of,
percentage, yeah.
And only 10%
but
of...
I think they all kind of go with the same concept. Like, it's something you don't see. It's... so therefore you can have an advantage.
Or there's some hidden advantage.
Yeah.
That, right, whatever. There is... now, on the other hand, they did a study, this was out of Australia, lefties 2 times more likely to die in war. And some of that is thought to be because of the weapons.
I would say the equipment is largely built for
I mean, the truth of the matter is...
Handheld stuff, yeah.
Lefties are discriminated against, right? Like, in the way people make things, but also just, like, in our language, right? Like, right, and, like, right is synonymous with being right-handed, right? Right. It's right. I mean, look at French. In French, what is it? A la droite?
Droite.
Droite, yeah. Was adroit, essentially, is right-handed, and gauche,
right,
which is like whatever. That's not good. You don't want to be gauche. That is left-handed.
Yeah. Gauche means exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah. So we do have it, but what's interesting is the list of lefty quarterbacks. Like, is it a disadvantage, or is it maybe there? It's just you should get about 10%. Like, if you were just going by the math, you should get about 10% of your sporting world, of your quarterbacks, of your good quarterbacks, of your great quarterbacks, just by math, should be lefties. The only ones who like leap to mind, Steve Young,
yep,
and Kenny Stabler, and then Michael Vick was great as well, Boomer Esiason, but there's not a lot of great, none of the greats, none of the absolute greats, lefty. Is it a disadvantage to be lefty? I mean, people talk about the blind side, but you would think the unexpectedness, the surprise of it would work in some ways well in football, too. It does not.
Well, this is why Belichick used to always have left-footed punters. Remember that? Remember when he was on a left-footed punter craze because the ball spins? So it's the same argument. For receivers, most of them have caught passes from right-handed quarterbacks their whole lives when the ball is spinning in the opposite direction. But, I don't know. It's always been weird to me because I think left-handers in general do everything prettier. But I don't know if that's just because your mind is...
Except right. If you see
but I'm
someone
like a
lot of times when they're throwing the ball, yes, or serving,
it looks prettier. Swing looks prettier.
It's much cooler.
Yeah.
There's no question. But when you see a lefty writing, they look like they're all curled around. Like,
well, the counterpoint to me was Tebow changed everything. When you saw Tebow throw, you're like, oh, that's not pretty.
No, that is
that's
not pretty.
Not pretty at all.
That is not pretty. Anyway, happy International Left-Handers Day.
You know what? I think we only have one right now, right? Tua? Starter?
Is that true?
I think Tua's the only left-handed starter.
Let's see. Other news. We're going to take a break here in a minute. I'll tell you why I'm so outraged. But a couple bits of news as well. First of all, it's golf week, and we haven't really mentioned that much on this show. But it is...
Well, we couldn't officially announce it until Kuchar finished out yesterday.
Until Kuchar finished out. Did we ever get an explanation as to why Kuchar would not finish his round on Sunday, thereby making everyone come back on Monday? He had nothing to play for. There was no point in doing this at all except for being a jackass. Did he say? Did he explain?
No, he gave a Matt Kuchar, like, double-faced. So the two prevailing thoughts are, on Sunday, they all had to play a ton of golf because the first 2 days were washed out. So on 18, he thought... Because everyone was talking about it. He hits into the group in front of him. The prevailing thought is that he was told it's clear by...
I don't blame him for that. That's
right,
that
but
was
so
a,
apparently yeah. When he hits into the group, he gets embarrassed, and he kind of... It was like a silent protest. The other thought was the pace of play. Like, he was protesting pace of play and how bad it was.
But they're both basically tantrum.
Correct.
They're both like, there's no reason to do this except for to be I am going to make you all, screw you, double bird, I'm going to make you come back tomorrow.
Correct. And those two seem to be the prevailing thoughts because there was no real reason to wait money-wise. Like, he was already out of, he'd already played himself out of keeping his streak going, whatnot. So everyone seems to think it's all temper tantrum based.
Anyway, great week over there at Southwind. If you've not gotten your passes, I urge you to do so. It really is fun. It really is a great scene. And you can go down to get Birdies and Bubbles, where they have one of the great chicken sandwiches, speaking of food.
Can't wait.
Of all time.
You can really, it pairs also very nicely with the Pronto Pup you can get at the 14th tee.
Very nicely, yes. with the Pronto Pup. There was news from Memphis basketball. Jeremy Kipnis, who was recruiting coordinator, he is gone. And listen, he left for an assistant's job, right? There's no, that's what you want. You want people on your staff.
That's moving up.
To move up. It just so happens, though, that it's a little... It's just amazing. It's just like Penny over there. He's like the only thing that comes back every year, right? I mean, obviously not this year. We've got
Rick,
a very prominent assistant who's back, and Rick. But Andy Borman's gone. Garrett Kelly's gone. Darby Rich is gone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole team pretty much is gone. So, but again, there's no shame in that. That's what you want. You want people to get assistant coaching jobs. If they can, in terms of the NFL, Jeffrey, the one news that was sort of people are talking about today a little bit is this Hassan Reddick thing. Hassan Reddick has asked for a trade. He was a pass rusher, who the Jets acquired, and he wants a new deal.
Yep.
And he didn't get a new deal. And so now he wants to be traded. And honestly, the whole thing what strikes me with this more than anything, is you talk about the Jets as an organization. If you reflect back to the Aaron Rodgers missing mandatory minicamp, right? What that really was it's just
failure
stupid.
To communicate.
It's a total failure to communicate. Like, in the end, Aaron Rodgers should have found out when minicamp was. Instead, he looked up when it was last year and then booked a trip to Egypt based on that. Whereas all you have to do is call and figure out, hey, when's mandatory minicamp? I'm booking a trip to Egypt. Like, in the end, it's just like they don't do the obvious thing in terms of communicating and figuring things out that would have avoided this situation. And the same thing's true with Hassan Reddick. Like, now we thought he was going to come in and we'd... No, in the end, you make absolutely certain you communicate with Hassan Reddick to such a way that everyone is 100% totally clear, I'm going to come in and play on this contract, or I'm going to come in and play on this contract while we renegotiate another one, or I'm not going to come in and play on this contract, and here's the terms of the next one. It's just... It shouldn't have gotten here. It is a symptom of the exact same situation that you have, and it gives me hope as someone who wishes nothing but ill on the New York Jets. It gives me some hope, because I have some concerns about them. It gives me some hope that, in fact, they are a dysfunctional organization, and this year will be a failure ultimately.
I guess, in fairness to the Jets, there's plenty of other examples I can go to about dysfunction. To me, this one just seems obvious. He's under contract. Like, it kind of all goes back to the same thing we were talking about with Ayuk, where you and I have talked about, we should always remember, whenever you get these dramatic pieces of news, think back to where you were the very first moment when you heard the news. What was your reaction? I use the DeAndre Williams example. When we first heard DeAndre was going to try for an extra year of eligibility, we thought, no harm, no foul, seems unlikely.
Right.
Well, then it got all dramatic. Everyone's feeling excited.
So what did you think when you heard this one? How does that apply?
It's the same thing with Ayuk, where your first instinct is, okay, well, Brandon Ayuk's just going to go back and play for the Niners. Like, it'll take twists and turns, but like, he's going to wind up playing for the Niners. To me, it's the same thing with Reddick, where...
I don't know. I can't think of another example where you acquire a guy without figuring out the contract stuff in advance, and so you acquire a guy who immediately holds out. I've never heard that. Like the Bears acquired, what's his name, from Washington, right? The defensive Sweat.
Montrez
Sweat. And so what they do, they acquire him last year.
Yep.
And they knew, because they knew that he was going to want a new contract. And so if you're giving up assets for him, you talk, you figure it out, and then you give him the new contract. You don't trade for a guy. You can't stop your own receiver like Brandon Ayuk from holding out if he wants to hold out or whatever else. But you don't go acquire a guy who then holds out without knowing what the situation would be. That seems to me to be preposterous.
What if they thought they had a number and then Reddick all of a sudden comes back?
Well, they get back to the failure to communicate. Like right here, whatever, the sides are very clearly... They did not communicate clearly. I suppose it's possible that Hassan Reddick had, oh yes, I'm definitely 100% coming in, and then he just did a 180 and changed his mind. It seems
but
to
that
me
would
that
also,
this is the kind
me, though,
of thing.
If that were the case, that's even better for you. That means he came in, he went from a professional organization to the
you
Jets.
You can argue that in the end, this will work out fine, because he's got a $14 million contract. He will play.
I mean, to me,
he ultimately will play.
It all kind of comes back to the same thing. It's a negotiation. And what the thing that seems different now to me, more so than in years prior, is I don't know if it's agents, I don't know if it's players, I don't know if it's teams, but the negotiations are now just being very public. Like, everyone's negotiating through the media.
If you're selling your house, I'm going to tell you when we come back, by the way, why I'm so outraged on behalf of the Grizzlies about the Little League, the Olympics. I'll ask Jeffrey if he shares my outrage. But first, I will tell you, if you are selling your house, you should call Josh Heisa. And this is pretty simple. He will give you, you will get a cash offer on your home. Like, it's tricky. Like, it's a tricky time to sell houses right now. The whole thing is tricky. The interest rates, the what's the market doing, et cetera. But if you list with Josh Heisa and his team at Keller Williams, you will get a cash offer on your home. Candace in Cordova, she did that. Josh was terrific throughout the process. Took exactly a week to sell her home, and Candace received more than she thought she would. Give him a call. See for yourself. The phone number, 901-461-8147. It's Josh Heisa. Once again, 901-461-8147 or joshhasthebuyers.com. Back in a moment. It's Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. We were making, we were talking about the taking the preseason pledge, which is you do not put stock in the preseason, right, Jeffrey? That's the rule here. But you were just telling telling me that the teams that went 3-0 last year in the preseason were
the Pittsburgh Steelers, as you mentioned off the top of your head.
They did make the playoffs.
Correct. The Washington Commanders
did not.
And the Jacksonville Jaguars.
So there you go. Whatever you think, though, of the NFL, right now over at FanDuel, you can get your future bets in. Whether it's teams that are going to make the playoffs, Super Bowl matchups, player props, passing yards, touchdowns, rushing, receiving totals, whatever. You think you know what's going to happen this NFL season, get your future bets in over at FanDuel. And right now, new customers can get $150 in bonus bets if your first $5 bet wins. One measly $5 bet winning, and all of a sudden, you got $150 in bonus bets to bet on whatever you like. Just got to pop over to FanDuel.com/Calkins, C-A-L-K-I-N-S, C-A-L-K-I-N-S, to sign up today. That's the promo code, Calkins, C-A-L-K-I-N-S. S must be 21 or older in present Tennessee. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call Tennessee Redline 1-800-889-9789. Got a busy second hour. Jennifer Chandler, food writer at the Daily Memphian, is going to join us. Then Fish on Friday on Tuesday. Before that, however, I told you I was outraged. And Jeffrey, I am outraged. This one, honestly, it's preposterous. David Aldridge, gifted NBA writer that he is ranking the offseason of every NBA team, okay, in reverse order, worst to first, 30 to 21. Guess who is worst?
Is it our Grizzlies?
Your Memphis Grizzlies! With all due respect, that's just stupid. It's just stupid. Like, this is what he said. The skinny. I don't hate the Grizzlies. I don't hate the Grizzlies. But this exercise measures how much better a team is after its offseason moves than it was before, and Memphis just didn't do very much this summer. That doesn't mean I think the Grizzlies did nothing. I'm fine, for example, with him going for Edie at 9. He moved fast up draft boards after impressing in Chicago at the pre-draft combine, and he's a four-year player coming out of college with back-to-back consensus National Player of the Year awards. And he's 7'4", 290, and should help immediately. But Memphis's biggest offseason question is whether Morant is back up to speed and again dominant by the start of camp. That's true. That is the big question. The big question is the health. But the idea that they had the worst, The Clippers lost Paul George, for God's sakes.
And replaced with whom?
The Nuggets lost Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, for God's sakes. Like, I get that you can say the Grizzlies, if you want to just say they did nothing. By the way, sometimes doing nothing when you think you might be losing things is good. And then to be able to quote-unquote, do nothing, to fill your biggest need at center, to bring Kennard back, to remain under the tax and have full flexibility, picks, everything else going forward.
And to get rid of your crowding problem without really spending a real asset.
They did not go get some glamorous piece to add. But you're ranking them behind a team that lost Paul George and a team that lost Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. It's just stupid. You're ranking them behind, like, the Wizards. Let Tyus just walk out the door like they could have traded him at the trade deadline. There are teams that did stupid things. The Grizzlies did smart things, marginal smart things, knowing their situation. It's just moronic. I am outraged.
I mean, it always comes back to the same question. What would you have had them do?
It's just stupid. With all due respect, it's just stupid. They have not. If you want to, honestly, like, if you want, like, right now he has the bottom 10 or something. He's unveiling them the way the Daily Memphian unveiled our ranking of greatest players. It's the NBA offseason. He needs some content over a couple of days. So today he did 30 to 21. And if you want to put them in this group, I would push back against that. But if you wanted to, because what did they do really this offseason? If you go back to the Adams trade, they basically traded Stephen Adams for Zach Edey.
Yeah.
Right? That's really what they did. And you can say, shrug. That's fine. If you want to put him in this group, it's not where I would put him, but I get it. But the idea that they had the worst offseason of any team is just stupid, with all due respect. Okay. Secondly, I am outraged. Okay, maybe mildly, maybe less so. I am outraged that the Court of Arbitration has ruled that Jordan Chiles, they're not going to reopen that case, and she is not going to get her bronze medal back. By the way, Steve Cohen has weighed in on this with a letter to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, saying, "While the Olympic Games should not be political, they teach lessons well beyond sports. Again, I urge you to reconsider this misguided move to strip Ms. Chiles of her medal, which, if left to stand, may forever tarnish the Olympic Games." Here's the thing. Do I really care that much? No. About this? No. But if in the end, and for those of you who are following along, and we're getting to the point where we very quickly will forget everything that happened in the Olympics, right? We're getting to that point. But following along, Jordan Chiles originally did not win a medal. The U.S. team protested, and they protested basically on the merits of what happened. Hey, she did this thing. You didn't give her enough points because she did this difficulty thing. And so they looked back, and they said, she did do the difficulty thing. And they gave her the extra credit, and she goes up to 3, okay? Knocking out the Romanian, who had been 3. So then the Romanians challenge, and they say, you didn't get your complaint in on time. You have 1 minute to file your objection, and you did not do that in a minute. And so therefore, boom, we're taking the medal away. Now, let's be honest. Even that is pretty, that's not losing on the merits. That's losing because they say you were 4 seconds behind. That has nothing to do with Jordan Chiles, what she did, right?
Yes.
She won the bronze medal. That's just that is a ticky-tack ass reason to take away her bronze medal. But then the U.S. says they have video that shows that, in fact, the objection was filed at 47 seconds. And the Court of Arbitration for Sport says, we can't consider that. It's like it's unreviewable. You know, we can't consider that. So
it's like pass interference. You can't.
It's total BS. So it's like here we have something that I'm going to just say. I mean, if they have video, I'm going to say it clearly establishes when the thing was filed. The reason you took it from her to begin with is a pretty ticky-tack reason. And by the way, now it clearly was wrong, and you can't fix it? That's outrageous! They're now going to appeal. I don't know how this all works. I don't know the jurisdictional rules here. They're now going to appeal to the Swiss Federal Tribunal. God bless them. I trust the Swiss. You do too, don't you?
Absolutely.
Don't you trust the Swiss? Do you have any thoughts on this?
So the question that I had at the beginning is, how how are they accepting the claim that it's 4 seconds late? I assume that that has to be video review, correct?
I don't think it was video review.
So why?
I have no evidence that it was video review.
What I don't understand is why can you take one claim that it's 4 seconds and then you can't take another claim? No, it was 13
I think
seconds
it's the,
under.
Because this was their arbitration ruling, and their arbitration ruling can't be appealed. The first time they were not appealing an arbitration ruling, they were going to the Sport of Arbitration on a ruling by the judges, right? By the IOC or whatever. It was appealed to the court, and you cannot review that ruling. Those rulings are unreviewable. So the merits of it, you're exactly right. The whole thing's ridiculous. Anyway, I continue to be out.
I mean, it's kind of the opposite of what we were talking about last week when they went back and awarded the 08?
I don't understand what
Jordan still got the podium.
Just give two, man. I get it. Everyone doesn't want ice cream for everybody or trophies for
everybody.
But
we're also arguing over the bronze.
This is stupid. She'll win more. The Little League World Series starts Wednesday.
Hooray.
And BetOnline.ag is offering odds on this. And the operator says the sport has seen a rapid rise in popularity. The Little League World Series is an exciting tournament that our customers absolutely love to watch and wager on. We'll take more bets on these Little League games than we will on any professional tennis or soccer matches over the next 2 weeks. It's Little League, Jeffrey. That's outrageous.
So
we should not be betting on Little League.
I can agree with you on that point. I think the problem is it's going to be flooded on ESPN. It's going to be unavoidable.
And so,
and the only way to watch Little League Baseball is by betting on it.
So I shouldn't be outraged by this.
Correct.
One.
But I understand the moral argument.
It is kind of ridiculous.
I agree. But if you've ever had to sit down and watch.
Where do these kids think the money comes from, though? You know, like the money doesn't just grow on trees, you know?
Correct, but you could also make that argument for the Little League World Series. Where do you think that TV contract's going?
Let's see. Other things to be outraged by. Oh, back to the Olympics. You saw this, I'm sure. Tyreek Hill.
Yes.
Tyreek Hill.
Yes.
Says, I would beat Noah Lyles. He did concede, not by much, but in a foot race.
That was very humble.
He would beat Noah Lyles. Now, Tyreek Hill, fast man. Can we agree on that?
Yes.
But the idea that he would say that he is faster than Noah Lyles, the fastest man in the world, that's outrageous. That's outrageous.
Haven't we seen Tyreek do track stuff? And it's like he's clearly fast, but he's not track fast.
Is this like people saying a college team will beat a...
Yeah, similar.
Beat the Hornets, you know, whatever else. Yeah, exactly. Could Bama beat the Jags?
Yeah.
It's just a different league, with all due respect, Tyreek. And you're exactly right. We have seen him run before in track.
Correct.
So he participated in the National Junior College Track Championships, did Tyreek Hill. And he ran a fast 100.
Yes.
He ran the 100 in 9.98.
Okay, so about half a
Lyles
second.
Lyles his best is 9.784. Jeffrey, I'm not really good at math. Which is faster? 9.98 or 9.78?
9.78, 2/10.
9.78, dramatically faster.
I will say, you know what the interesting thing to me is? Normally when you have, like, if you win a gold, particularly like in the 100, you come across looking great. I think Noah Lyles might have somehow, like, everyone felt like, it felt like by the end of it, everyone just had enough of Noah Lyles. Like, he felt like the one guy that came out of the Olympics, and you would think that he should have come out looking better.
Well, the guy, if you're asking me who came out, who comes out of the Olympics looking worse? I do agree that Noah Lyles should look better than he looks. Because then there's the COVID, he has the failure, no one likes him, evidently.
Well, he did the wheelchair, and then, like, 10 minutes later, he's celebrating. And
So, I still think marginally positive, but not as... I think Noah Lyles positive.
I think he...
Positive, but not as much as he should be.
I think he increased his visibility and it comes back to no such thing as good publicity.
Well,
I think, but there are more people that are like, I've had enough of him.
Well, that goes back to our breaker.
Yes. Right?
Ray Gunn.
Yes.
Ray Gunn G, or whatever her name is. G, Ray Gunn. What would be?
A kangaroo.
A kangaroo. In the end, she is now the most famous breaker in the world.
Yes. I don't even know who won the competition, to your point.
She is the most famous.
Correct.
But did she come out ahead? Maybe. Maybe.
I think it helps, though, that breaking is...
We're laughing at it anyway.
Right. It's not a competition that is an Olympic sport. Like, it was here for... It's a one-off. And whereas Lyles, you win the 100, you should come across as, a hero.
So how about as people who had the worst Olympics? Obviously, there are lots of people who sunk their heart and soul and dreams in 4 years in the Olympics and came up short.
Yeah.
Probably many of them whose names I don't know.
Sure.
Most of them, they're the names I don't know, who had really crushing, depressing Olympics. The person I'm going to name has a lot to fall back on in terms of riches, fame, accomplishment, et cetera else. My heart does not bleed.
Okay.
Jason Tatum.
Yeah.
There's a story in The Athletic about, can they make it up to Jason Tatum? Jason Tatum was talking about his Olympic experience and said, as he has a gold medal around his neck, it was a tough personal experience on the court, but I'm not going to make a decision about whether he's going to play in the future off of emotions. If he asked me right now if I was going to play in 2028, it's 4 years from now, and I would have to take time and think about it. So I'm not going to make any decision based off how this experience was or how I felt individually. Implied in all of that was this experience sucked.
Yes.
Right? This was humiliating.
Yeah.
I just won a championship. I should be at the apex of my career, breaking out as a star, and I'm just literally taking a seat behind the megastars.
Yes. And I mean, I know it's not technically apples to apples, but my teammate, Derek White, played more than I did.
Yeah, and that too. Yes, it is not apples to apples, but still. I do understand why he'd be irked, but I think he just looks diminished by it. It all served, I don't blame anyone for it, but it served as a reminder of these are the superstars, whether it's Tyrese Halliburton or Jason Tatum or all you people who sat down, you are not. These are, you are not.
Well, I think the other thing it kind of brings to top of mind is LeBron, Steph, and KD to a lesser degree have carried this league for 20 years. If you think back to who's going to carry it for the next 10 years, do you even put an American in the list?
No, it's why, by the way, I think, right now, let me ask you this. Next Olympics, U.S. or the field, gold medal.
I think you still have to take the U.S. from depth. To me, the thing that stood out in this Olympics...
You'll also have home court.
Yes, you'll have home court. But the thing that really stood out in this Olympics to me is the world has caught up in terms of, putting a starting five out there, but we just absolutely run them out of the gym when our second unit gets in.
Yeah, I don't know, though. You don't really need that much of a second unit. In the end, Serbia with one guy, one dude, nearly took him down, right?
He played
the whole game.
Yeah.
One guy in shooters who had good games, shooters.
Yeah.
But to your point, it's why I think Ja is so important, honestly. If he is the Ja he was on the trajectory he is a difference maker.
Correct.
Anyway.
And he gives them something they haven't really had in the Olympics, which is true point guard that can break down defense and make everything else easier.
I am not actually outraged by this, but I can pretend to be for the purposes of this segment. Top 25, AP top 25 out yesterday, and Memphis was not, certainly was not included. Whatever you call Notre Dame, it was Power 5 teams in Notre Dame.
Yeah.
That was the entire top 25. So there was no
By the way, it was the same 25 teams from the coaches' poll, just in different order.
But Memphis was not the first
Correct. Group
of five team if you go to other receiving votes, and Memphis was not the second. Boise State had a total of 47 points. They would have finished, if you extrapolate, 28th. Liberty, 32 points. They would have finished 31st. Memphis, 10 points. They would have finished 34th. Our old friend Steve Johnson, he voted. He had Memphis at 25th. And so that's nice. Eight voters actually had Memphis 24th or 25th. Very quickly behind Memphis was UTSA and Tulane. So not really outraged. The truth of the matter is you know, the schedule is such that I sort of understand it. But is there any room for outrage there, Jeffrey?
I don't think so. I mean, I still think, like, this is all just going to kind of play itself out. I think the thing that's going to be more interesting to me is it feels like if it's going to end up becoming a Boise-Memphis question, Boise's going to take their loss week two at Oregon. Memphis is likely to take their loss week three at Florida State. The question for me will become who gets ranked first, because I think whoever gets ranked first
of
is going to...
Of Memphis and who gets back, Boise State, who gets back in first?
Correct. Because to me, it feels like... I don't really care that Liberty's going to be there. Like, I think Liberty's going to have Liberty's going to have an uphill battle because of what we saw last year. To me, it's going to be the race of who gets back ranked first, because what we've seen is, like, there's a hesitancy to just flip somebody at the end of the season.
In terms of the rest of it, if you look at this at tiers, do you put Georgia and Ohio State in a tier of their own? And is the difference there quarterback, why you would have Georgia ahead of Ohio State?
Yes.
I think that's right.
To me, it's like they've separated themselves.
Is there then a clear next tier for you?
Yeah, I can't decide if I want it to be another small tier or if I'm making it another lump. I think clearly for me the next tier is Oregon and Texas. Uh-huh. If you want to make a case for Alabama being in that tier, I'm fine. But I would kind of say that's like a tier slightly
below.
Would
you put Alabama in this year, same tier as Ole Miss?
Only because I think Alabama's schedule's tougher. Like, I think Alabama's going to top to bottom be a better football team, but I'd rather have Ole Miss's schedule.
And then, of course, it's interesting that there are questions that emerge every time you see this in discussion points. The one that I see, I've seen lots of places, is people have pointed out that every year, basically for the last two decades, except for 2019, a team that is in the AP top 10 finishes the season, at least one, finishes the season unranked. And so who will be the team? I think it's... My guess is, I have a pretty clear guess here. Who will be the team that is currently ranked in the top 10 that will finish unranked?
I'm going to say, of all these options, I'm probably going to say Michigan.
That's what I was going to say.
But last year, I think, it was USC?
Last year was USC. Last year, USC. And USC was a disaster.
Yeah.
Last year, like, what did we miss? The offensive line was a disaster. Like, last year, they just got beat up.
Yeah, we missed that, but also it's like, I don't know, they were the team that went so transfer-heavy the year before, the mix wasn't there last year.
Like the Tiger basketball team last year. Very similar. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk to Jennifer Chandler. She's the food writer for the Daily Memphian. We'll talk to Jennifer about all sorts of stuff going on. Then Fish on Friday on Tuesday. Before that, I will remind you, if you've got a big yard or a piece of land you're taking care of, go see the smaller Case IH tractors at Mid-South Ag Equipment in By Hellier. They're in stock now. 0% financing now. And listen, you don't have to be a big old farmer. If you got a nice piece of property, you're bush hogging, got a garden, whatever it is, tractors are great. Tractors are useful. Tractors are fun. And the Case IH tractor is perfect for your needs. Forget green. Go big red with a smaller Case IH tractor from Mid-South Ag Equipment. In stock right now, Highway 302 in By Hellier. Jennifer Chandler coming up next. It is the Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. So typically at 10 o'clock, Straight up 10 o'clock, we've got Chris Harrington. He is in Scotland eating haggis, I can only presume. We are now joined in his stead by Jennifer Chandler, who writes about food and dining for the Daily Memphian on Twitter at CookWJennifer. Let's cook with Jennifer on Twitter. I'm sure you can find her on Instagram and everywhere else. Jennifer joins me now. Jennifer, first, because Scott is in Scotland, have you ever eaten haggis?
You know, I had tried haggis once 100 years ago. I studied in college in London. I did a semester abroad and tried some interesting things over there. And I will just say, I've never tried it again.
That seems sensible. So, all right.
I will give a shout out that every year, DJ Naylor, who owns Celtic Crossing and Bog and Barley,
yep.
He does
Robert Burns.
Exactly.
Night.
Exactly. Yep. I was going to say it's Burns. And he serves haggis once a year. So if you love haggis, you can find it in Memphis.
In fairness, also serves whiskey. If you would prefer whiskey, right? He would also serve whiskey at that event. Jennifer Chandler recently came over to the Daily Memphian. You can read her stuff over there. So you have a story today, or yesterday, I guess it went up, about the Bayou Bar and Grill. And honestly, it's some good news in the wake of the difficult times that restaurants are having now, which I want to talk about in a minute. But what's happening at the Bayou Bar and Grill?
Yes, it's very exciting. So the Bayou has been kind of, I was trying to think about it, is that probably, I didn't confirm this, there could be some other tenants over there, but as far as restaurants go, I think it is the longest running restaurant in Overton Square, and it has just stood the test of time. And for the past 30 years, it's been run by Bill and Carla Baker, who is this couple, and they've just put their heart and soul into that restaurant, and it is now time for them to retire. Bill told me that he has gone fishing, is what he said.
Uh-huh.
And it has been bought by two of their longtime managers and employees that have worked there for many, many years. And they've also brought in Crosby Keltner, who is a restaurateur that's worked in many Memphis restaurateurs. He's been living in Nashville, and he moved back to Memphis to help purchase the Bayou. And they said that they're going to bring it into its next 30 years. They're very excited. I think it's a really interesting, when you look at restaurants and people doing this, like the perfect combination, because you're bringing somebody who has not worked there before but has frequented it and knows it for many, many years. But he brings a different set of experience. But then you also have two employees that have been there for decades that know the staff, know the food, know the customers, and know what the customers want. And I think that's a perfect marriage to bring a restaurant into its next chapter.
It's nice to see these success stories. There are others. I guess the Half Shell recently changed hands, and a lot of you see places that are continuing in different renditions. But we have seen too often, and it's interesting how it works. I was commenting earlier at the top of the show that people who write about food and restaurants, it feels like you should be writing about food and restaurants, but whether once upon a time it was about COVID or now it's about inflation and crime and whatnot, it feels like it's the sort of the front line of writing about society and economics and everything else. And so lately we have had this raft of restaurant closings. Most recently, bar closings was Blind Bear last week. We've had Buckley's close, a lot of others closed. When you've talked to to the folks behind this, and I know you've done a bunch of these interviews, what is there one reason? Is it a combination of reasons? Typically, what I've noticed happens is one closes, people immediately use it as a reason to sort of bludgeon Memphis and say, this is crime, this is a disaster, it's a horrible place. Even like, what is your experience actually talking to these people about what they're dealing with?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not one simple answer, unfortunately. And there are a lot of factors that go into it. But, you know, I interviewed Ben Smith for an article recently, and he really put it correctly. He said he has customers. Ben Smith owns Tsunami Restaurant in Cooper Young neighborhood, and it's been there for over 25 years, I think, now. And it's a wealth of wealth of experience. And he said the past 4 years have been like no other he has ever seen in his entire career in the restaurant industry. But he said that he sees customers come in and they look around his dining room, which is busy and bustling and looks full, and they're like, oh, you made it, you're doing great. And Ben says he just has to sit there and smile, but inside he's partially dying because he's like, this is still so hard that the restaurant industry has, restaurateurs are still reeling from the effects of what happened 4 years ago. And, you know, they bear the brunt of it. It was either him or James Terrace, who owns
Jim's Place
Grill in Collierville. I forget which one of them said it. I think they both kind of echoed the same sentiment, is that when you look at a restaurant, is a restaurant deals with so, it's the front line on so many different things. They are, you know, they're having to get supplies from different places. They're having to manufacture the supplies. They're having their own salespeople. They really kind of cover the gamut when you look at it, work experience on what a company is. They're not just one cog in a wheel. They actually kind of encompass all the different cogs in the wheel. And so when something changes, it really impacts how their business operates. And there have been a lot of things that, you know, when we talk about inflation, that is obviously one. Everybody feels it. Even when you go to the grocery store, you see the cost of goods have gone up. I mean, there have been some crazy things with, like, eggs last year, where eggs went through the roof. There's a spinach dish that's on the menu at out in Collierville at Jim's Place Grill that he had to take off temporarily because he couldn't afford it because the cost of eggs was so high. Butter has gone high. All of these things really impact a restaurant's bottom line. I have a story that went out last week on that subject about what goes into the price of a dish. But then you have things like when COVID hit, there was a correction in the labor market for restaurants.
Right.
Some of it good, some of it bad. Lots of longtime professional restaurateurs and servers and chefs went on to find different jobs, and they haven't returned. And part of that, it made the labor costs go up, which is a good thing. That probably needed to be a correction. However, now restaurateurs are finding people coming in and applying for jobs have less experience.
Right.
And so they're having to now invest in
well, it's funny.
It's a roller coaster.
My wife's son works at Catherine and Mary's and loves it, by the way. Loves it. But it is interesting because now I have this window into it. And it feels like people who are servers, and this is no less true at Catherine and Mary's, where I think it's a pretty established group, but they can just quit their job today and get a new job tomorrow easily. Like it's I couldn't imagine hiring at a restaurant because, so anyway, so you got food costs going up and all of this is COVID related. So you originally had the COVID, you know, disaster, and then coming out of it, as we recovered, as the economy recovered, money was pumped in. Then you have the inflation, you have the rising wages, and then you have crime layered on top of that as well. And so maybe fewer people come out, whatever else. I was interested, just real quick, on the Ben Smith story. He talked about the sea bass, which I love.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. But
it's a fabulous dish.
It made it sad to me to realize that he doesn't make any money on sea bass.
Not at all. It was one of those things that I actually had dinner there this weekend, and I was like, I started to order it, and I was like, I don't know if I can order it now. It's my favorite dish. But I will. But it is interesting when you have something like that, you know, you've become known for, and, you know, he knows that people would get upset if he takes it off the menu. Longtime customers like myself who love it and like you who love it will probably complain. And then he has people that, you know, it's written about so much. He has people that come in specifically for new customers that come in to try it. And, you know, there's that whole idea of the lost leader. But it's, you know, it used to be you'd have one item on your menu like that. But it's just beginning to get a lot harder because prices are changing so much. Changing within, you can't change your prices on a daily basis, which is what you'd have to do right now because your purveyors are changing the prices on a daily basis because there is a fire in California, which makes the price of avocados go up, or there is a one of the things I found really interesting is like Hurricane Beryl, or I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but the hurricane that came through Texas last month, it impacted pineapples. And now pineapples are through the roof. I mean, so it's like any of these natural disasters, politics, this was interesting. I guess a lot of politics must come from South America, because he said a lot of there's issues with the Colombian cartel that impact the price of an avocado.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, that's what one of the food surveyors.
Talking to Jennifer Chandler from the Daily Memphian. And it also, I mean, you talked to Ben Smith at Tsunami, but also Eric Vernon, for example, at the barbecue shop. The bologna sandwich, is that right?
Yes, I mean, that was crazy. He looked at me and I wish I could show you a picture of the expression on his face. He was like, I never thought I'd ever have on my menu the bologna sandwich be more expensive than our pork shoulder sandwich. But that's the case now. And because, again, prices of things, beef have gone up through the roof, but he is adamant. He goes, we serve an all-beef bologna. It's a really high-quality bologna he sources, but it's gotten really expensive to serve in comparison to what it used to be. Yeah. I mean, it's still an inexpensive sandwich. I think it's somewhere around $10 or $11, but compared to where it used to be, it's more expensive.
A couple other things, Jennifer, before we let you go. In addition to writing about all of these trends in restaurants and the food industry, happily you get to write about food as well.
You wrote about
this restaurant that I have not been to called GEM, which stands for Just Enjoy the Moment. And I have to say, the matzo ball stuffed chicken, it sounded great. I don't know that it sounded better than the warm crab and shrimp dip, though. The words warm crab and shrimp together seems pretty good. Tell me about this restaurant, by the way. It's in the Edge District.
It's in the Edge District, and it opened in April. Josh Munchnick and his wife Emily opened it, and it is. There's a new building that was. I think it's a new building, or it's been a really remodeled building that popped up, I guess, a couple of years ago. The first thing that went in there was Rootstock Wine Merchants, which is a fabulous wine shop if you've never been to it. The owner is just, Scott is so knowledgeable about wines. So they have some interesting different things. But he's on one side of the building. The other side is across from Phillips Recording Studio over there on Madison, kind of in that Edge District. And it is, you walk in, it is, it's a comfortable, casual type feeling restaurant, kind of like upscale casual, I guess I should say. But the food is really interesting. Josh started as a pop-up that he did out of one of the houses in Victorian Village, and I totally forget which one as we're talking. And he did that for a year or two before he opened his own restaurant. And the food is just really, really well executed. Everything is a little bit different. And I never order chicken at a restaurant, and I only ordered this dish because he said, this is one I'd recommend you try. And I was blown away because it was like chicken was tender and flavorful, and it was different, and it was having myself studied went to culinary school in France and worked in that industry for a long time. It was like these French techniques perfectly executed, but with a fun little twist by making it with matzo ball seasoning. Everything we tried was really, really excellent, and I cannot say what a great experience we had. It's exciting to see, you know, when you talk about this age where people complain about things closing, it's exciting to see people opening things and kind of thinking outside of the envelope and offering something a little different. I really think that's the key to the success of a restaurant, is offering something that is unique and different and adds value to the life of the customer.
You're also doing recipe exchanges. And I have to say, of your recent recipe exchanges, people can read all this, by the way, over at the Daily Memphian. Follow Jennifer Chandler on all the social media outlets. I had my eye on the barbecue shrimp. Kelly English's barbecue shrimp, which I have had before and is so freaking delicious, I can't begin to describe it. So I don't know how what method of torture you applied to get Kelly to surrender this barbecue shrimp recipe, although it sounds like, from reading the piece, he does not recommend you make the actual 100% actual barbecue shrimp, because that takes roughly a month and 100,000 ingredients or something. This is a shorthand barbecue shrimp recipe?
Yes, this is the one he actually makes in his own home when he wants to make barbecue shrimp. At the restaurant, they make their own, you know, reduction of, you know, seafood stock, and they have all of these different spices, and there's a lot that goes into the version that they serve both at the Second Line at Restaurant Iris. But he said there was no way he would even attempt to make it at home, and he's a chef. So this is his version he makes for himself, and I have not cooked it yet, but it sounds like a great recipe, and I cannot wait to try it.
All right. Last thing, Jennifer, before I let you go. I eat everything. There's nothing I've never had haggis, so I can't say everything, but literally everything I've eaten I like, except for eggplant, which I loathe. So the challenge is this. If I was to eat one eggplant dish in Memphis that would change my mind about eggplant, what would be, didn't prepare you for this question, what would be the eggplant dish in Memphis that would change my mind about eggplant? Because I'm revolted by it. It goes back to some deep childhood trauma, I think. But I can't stand eggplant.
I'm giggling about this because I love eggplant, and I've had eggplant like 3 times this week at home because we got a big batch at the farmer's market. But I would say go to Kokoza and have the eggplant parmesan. Their version is, Patrick Riley's version is one of my favorites in town, and it is so good. And what is not love about slices of eggplant that are seasoned and battered in a crispy battered and fried and then smothered with a marinara sauce and mozzarella cheese, and it's comfort food. It's its best.
All right. Well, so and they, by the way, there's another success story. Downtown restaurant, The Majestic, which we talked about on this show before. But then they branch out in addition. The Majestic's obviously an institution, fabulous place. They branch out with Kokoza, which I gather is quite successful as a this cropped up during, like, originally as a pop up, and then Kokoza has been a very popular Italian place.
Yeah, and it's located on Harbortown, and they're about to open. They're another Latinite who's had a success story. They're about to open a second location of Kokoza later this fall. It's going to be kind of at the corner of Yates and Poplar.
Perfect, Jennifer. You're awfully nice to join us. Really do appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's Jennifer Chandler. From the Daily Memphian. Have you been to Kokoza, Jeffrey? You've been to Kokoza's?
I have not.
It's on my list. It's definitely on my list. And now Jem is J-E-M. It's spelled J-E-M.
Also, we almost went there.
It's also
we almost went there for my birthday, and then I decided, I was like, let's just hang out.
Wonderful to have Jennifer. She's been a terrific addition to the Daily Memphian. I would urge you to read her stuff over there. Fishman. Not yet at the Daily Memphian. We can work on that. But he is a regular here on Fish on Friday on Tuesday. We'll talk to Fishman next, our man in Washington, D.C. Before that, I will tell you, if you were looking for a new financial institution, or if you were looking for a home loan, or if you were looking for an auto loan, or whatever, if you're just honestly fed up with your bank, get in contact with Leaders, Leaders Credit Union. It is a fabulous place. I can say that because Claire opened up an account recently. Very happy. Among other things, you know, you're like, credit union. I like a big, mighty bank with lots of, Leaders has literally more fee. You get access to more fee-free ATMs at Leaders than at Bank of America. 85,000 of them. And because they're a credit union, they pour every penny that they earn into better technology, better rates, better service, all of that. Again, to find out more, go to LeadersCU. That's Leaders and then the letters CU.com/ESPN. N. Again, we went into, they have a location in Bartlett. That's where we went to open our account, but you can do it online, obviously. You know, there's no reason. They're also opening a new branch in Arlington as well. It's Leaders Credit Union. Fish on Friday coming up next. We'll do that in a second. 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Charles Fishman, our man in Washington, D.C., author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, most recently One Giant Leap, The Extraordinary Efforts of Ordinary Americans to Get Us to the Moon, also a 3-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award for Excellence in Business Writing, and retired Mississippi River tugboat deckhand. Happy International Left-Handers Day, Charles.
Do you know who's a famous left-hander that you left off?
Who's that?
Me.
Oh, I know that. Yes, I know you are a left-hander.
Oh, you didn't mention that.
That's why I wished you a happy Left-Handers Day.
Okay, but you never mentioned that I was a left-hander.
No, I could have. I could have put him on the list. I could have done...
You were going to say, who's a famous person I've left off? It's Charles Fishman.
I could have done a... I'm quizzing Jeffrey, who's a lefty and who's not, and I could have. Jeffrey. Jeffrey. Hold on, Jeffrey. Name, is it one? Is it neither? Or is it both? Lefties. Charles Fishman, Tim Calkins.
Both.
Both is correct answer. Very good. Nicely done. So, how do you feel about being a lefty, Charles? Is it part of your identity?
I think the one thing you didn't talk about, you said it's an advantage in professional athletics to be a lefty. I don't think that's true. I think it's still an advantage to be a right-handed person. It's just that left-handed people do well compared to the total population. You know, I know I'm a left-handed person every day. The most common way I know is we have scissors and shears in the kitchen. You got to open the bag of dog food. I use shears. You got to cut parsley or basil or whatever, you use scissors. Quote unquote ordinary scissors are right-handed scissors. The two blades of the scissors are bolted together so that when a right-handed person uses them, they get just a little tighter and the two blades cut crisply. When I use a pair of right-handed scissors, my left hand pushes the blades apart, and so the leaves of basil just bend and bruise. And when you use a pair of left-handed scissors, the blades are mounted in the other way, so they tighten. Now, a left-handed person at age 63 has learned to pull the blades together while cutting, so that my basil and my parsley actually chop, 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 or I could use a knife. But every single day, I know that I'm a left-handed person, and it does not surprise me at all to see that fatalities, accidents, I think if you look at industrial accidents, right-handed people are so immersed in their own world. You said, computers aren't right-handed.
You know what it is? It's privilege,
actually,
Charles.
They are.
It's privilege. It's privilege. You know what it is?
Yes, it's right-handed privilege.
Yes, exactly right. You are wrong about the lefties in baseball. It is, listen, I agree. I said you're discriminated against, even in language, even the way we describe it, you're discriminated against.
Right.
There are some small niches where it turns out to be positive. Your odds of becoming a baseball player are better, like if you're a lefty than a righty. That's just true.
It's 60% of. Okay, relative to the total left-handed population, that's true, but I don't know if it's...
Per capita, whatever, per percentage basis, whatever else. But anyway, happy Left-Handers Day to you, Charles. Do you have something you want to say about the Olympics?
Thank you. I just wanted to say one thing. There was right at the beginning, I was watching the Olympics. I'm sorry I didn't pay attention to who this was. It was a U.S. male athlete, and I don't remember if he was a swimmer or track and field or what, and he said, when you're an athlete, you think to yourself in your brain, I want to be the reason they play my national anthem. I want to be the reason they play my national anthem. And I just thought, God, that just captures what the emotion of being an Olympic athlete must be like. You know, that's just a beautiful, I just thought that was a beautiful way.
It's absolutely right. Like one of the moments that I think, well, wasn't one of my top five moments, but one of the moments from, I don't typically care about Olympic golf. You know, it doesn't feel like it should be an Olympic sport, but Scottie Scheffler wins. And as they're playing, like as a guy who won millions of dollars, he's the best golfer in the world. And as they're playing the national anthem, he literally has to take his arm and wipe away his tears.
He's just crying.
Fantastic. So there were a lot of things. I think people miss it. I think people miss the Olympics. I loved
having the Olympics going. I liked particularly the storytelling that you didn't have to know what the 100-meter men's 100-meter dash was, or you didn't have to know, you know, what the horse, you know, what dressage was.
Right.
They do the storytelling so well that you're absorbed in. Before we move on, just one quick thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting. Since the 60s, since the 70s, about half of U.S. presidents have been left-handed. Lefties.
Clinton was a lefty. Clinton was a lefty.
Harry Truman
was a lefty. Harry Truman
Gerald
was a lefty. Gerald Ford was a lefty.
Ronald Reagan, not many people know that. Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. So that's a lot of left-handed presidents, and if you look around at the world, I think they have quietly, secretly reshaped the world on behalf of left-handers.
Well, it is true. If you look up Wikipedia, you'll see that there's all kinds of read about handedness. There's all kinds of studies about whether it correlates with other things, right?
Intelligence and
whatever else. And there's some good, Charles. The good news, you as left-handed will know, there's some good. And there's some bad.
Right.
Like, there's some mental illness stuff going on there.
Correlates with bruised curves when you're chopping.
Okay, onward we go. Home Depot results today. What?
I wanted to just say one more thing. First of all, it dates back to 40,000 years. They found handedness in Neanderthals, so that's interesting.
Yes, but oddly enough, not today in modern apes. They're not right or left-handed.
And most animals don't show handedness, but I'm proud to say kangaroos do show handedness.
Really?
And most kangaroos are left-handed, and that tells everything you need to know about us crazy left-handers.
Right.
They're really just secretly kangaroos.
Inflation results.
Okay, inflation.
We don't really
do a little bit of a speed round.
Go ahead.
You want to set the timer for?
No, we're not doing a speed round. No.
Not doing modified speed.
I didn't prepare him for that. So inflation.
Producer prices came out this morning. Those are the prices that the companies we buy from, Walmart, Pizza Hut, McDonald's, Whirlpool, the big companies, these are the prices they pay before they sell the stuff to us. And inflation was much cooler than expected. July inflation was 0.1%. That's annualized to 1.2%. That's spectacular, the lowest in many months. And half of what was expected and half of what last month's inflation was. Inflation to the producer inflation, if you exclude food and energy, which are considered really volatile, which go up and down a lot, was 0%. So prices aren't coming down. You're not going to see your McDonald's super meal, you know, go from $9 to $7, but they've stopped going up. And that's really, really important. So that was good news. The same time this morning, go ahead. Next one is, do you want to call?
Home Depot results, yeah.
Home Depot had its earnings released this morning. We usually don't pay that much attention to Home Depot, but there's some interesting lessons in Home Depot this morning. Home Depot predicted that the second half of this year would be weaker than they thought, with sales at Home Depot's open a whole year down 3 or 4% for the whole year. So they're selling less than last year. Remember, Home Depot is one of the places that just exploded during the pandemic with people.
Right.
The CEO said this morning, people buying grills, people buying patio furniture, people buying desks for their home offices that they didn't ever have before. Here's what was interesting about what Home Depot said. Home Depot said they serve the professional renovation community, and they serve them more and more all the time, the people who come to your house and rebuild your bathroom or your kitchen. They serve those people, and they serve what they call DIY, do-it-yourself, with ordinary people doing their own stuff. Small projects this year are up, the kinds of things people walk in, buy the stuff, put it in the back of a minivan, they can do it. That's up. What's down is what they call finance projects, projects that require even a small loan to do, rebuilding the back deck, renovating the kitchen, renovating the bathroom, adding a bedroom, sales of lumber, sales of kitchen equipment, sales of bathroom equipment, sales of flooring and lighting, all down. Why? Well, interest rates are high. So people are like, do I really want to take a loan to renovate that bathroom, or should I wait? But now we're in the super pause because we
the
all
super
know,
pause? The super pause? Right. Aren't interest rates coming down a little bit now?
That's what the super pause is.
Oh, okay.
If you were hesitant to take a loan in March because of interest rates, now you're just standing there with your arms crossed. Jay Powell's going to lower interest rates
right.
3 weeks from now. Why would I take a loan now?
I see.
Let me just wait and see what happens, because the rates are going to come down. Actually, the same thing's going on with iPhones. We all know new iPhones are coming in September. No one buys an iPhone in August. No one. And so they said this is a moment when whatever was happening in April, May, or May, June, and July, August and September are going to be quiet, because people are waiting to do any significant project until the rates come down. Here's two little bits of data. Home sales, from the perspective of somebody like Home Depot, are kind of frozen because mortgage rates are so high.
Right.
People with low mortgage rates, not giving up their great low mortgage rate. People who want to move, look at the cost of moving. The average increase in mortgage payments from 3 years ago is $5,000 a year for the same home. You don't get anything for the $5,000.
Right.
So home sales before the pandemic in the U.S., these are homes that already existed, not new homes. People selling one and buying the next one that already existed, were $5 million a year. Right now, they're at $4 million a year or less. That's a 25% drop in sales of existing homes. What do you do when you buy a quote-unquote new home, a new-to-you home?
You fix it up, man. You change it up. You do some stuff. Yeah, right.
You
yeah.
do some stuff. Not huge stuff, but even if you spend $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000,
yeah, right, whatever.
You're doing that at Home Depot, right? And at the door store and places like that. Also, Home Depot mentioned that climate change was changing their sales in the last quarter. The heat arrived, the intense summer heat arrived early in June, pulled back sales they normally see of all kinds of cooling devices, air conditioners, small air conditioners, that fans, all that stuff from July back to June. So that was kind of interesting. Walmart, so they said the consumer's fine, but watchful because of interest rates. Walmart sales are Thursday. And Walmart's really a proxy for the consumer. Half of Americans shop at Walmart.
We will talk to you about Walmart next week.
Every week.
Starbucks fires its CEO. Now, as I recall, this is like a football coach. You hired as a football coach, and you get whatever you get a. You suddenly get 2 years, right? Only if you are a disaster do you get, like we just saw at Mississippi State this year, do you only get 1 year. Like, this is not working out. Evidently, that's what they basically hired the Mississippi State coach to be the CEO at Starbucks, at Starbucks, because they just fired the guy.
They fired the guy. His name I always have trouble coming up with his name. Laxman. Narasimhan.
We don't need the name.
Only been the CEO of Starbucks, not even a year and a half. March of 2023, handpicked by Howard Schultz, the founder and several times CEO, the first person to run Starbucks from outside Starbucks, considered just not up to the task. They fired him this morning. Literally, he's done. Like, his ID was revoked at 9 a.m., which is pretty unusual in itself, right? And they hired a guy named Brian Nickel, not a household name except for what he's been doing. He's been running Chipotle since 2018.
And Chipotle's crushing it. Crushing it.
Chipotle is crushing it. Since Nickel was hired, actually, from Taco Bell, of all places. Talk about a step up, right? It's like going from Walmart to Tiffany's.
Not disparage Taco Bell on this show. We will not have that.
Do I ever disparage Walmart?
No.
Walmart changed my life. I'm just saying a different category, Taco Bell and Chipotle. And hired in 2018, we forget, in 2018 people were just rolling their eyes at Chipotle because of the E. coli and stuff in their food was making people sick.
Right.
And that is a really good way to crash fast food sales. Hired in 2018, and since he was hired, at one point Chipotle stock was $3,500 a share. So Chipotle stock is five times what it was when he was hired. Revenue doubled in 5 years. Starbucks revenue during that period only up 50%.
I'll be honest. So it feels to me like, Charles, like I'm sure this isn't true. It feels to me like all these places, they run their course. You know, Starbucks is the hot thing, and then of course you're going to run aground at some point. It's just, whereas...
Right. How many more Starbucks do we need, and how much more Starbucks could we buy?
And then what happens is you end up diversifying and having too many stores, and so then ultimately you have to close the stores, and you have to say, we're going to focus on what we do well. Whereas Apple, it doesn't feel like... feels like... this is probably wrong. It feels like food companies... I don't know how you just grind
McDonald's
along year after year after year.
McDonald's is the best response to that, right? 10 years ago, you would have said, we really have all the McDonald's we need.
Right.
And we're really eating all the McDonald's we need
we
to
need
eat.
To.
And
but
the
it's
last
doing
10
fine.
Years, it's
doing,
just been...
Really?
Right. And the truth is that with a place like Starbucks, first of all, Chipotle...
Didn't you just have Chipotle for the first time?
I did have Chipotle for the first time. At an airport. Which airport was it? I can't even remember.
And you found it to be wanting. You did not. It did not satisfy you, Chipotle.
Well, I had Chipotle at an airport Chipotle, so there were no chips. They wouldn't give you chips. They had no chips. They had no guacamole. Like, what's Chipotle without guacamole? I stood in line for 25 minutes.
What it is Starbucks, honestly. Chipotle without Chipotle without guacamole, it might as well be Starbucks. That's what it is. Yeah, exactly right.
Right. So it was fine. I felt like, oddly, you know, I ate it on the plane. I felt like when we landed and got our luggage, I was kind of hungry again, which is sort of not what you're supposed to feel with Chipotle. So it was whatever. My kids are so devoted to Chipotle. But anyway, Starbucks is in trouble, but like all of China open to Starbucks, right? And China, by the way, has five times the number of people we have. So there's a lot of room to run, and that's what people want. And Starbucks is not what the criticism now is that Starbucks has sort of lost energy in the post morning, you know, time slot. People don't think about going to Starbucks
third place
in the afternoon for a coffee and for a drink and a snack. And I think Nichols' job is going to be to sort of provide that.
The food is pathetic at Starbucks. Food is pathetic.
The food has always been pathetic.
It's pathetic.
And if you could do something about that.
Okay, we have to move along because I'm really interested in some other topics. Go ahead. Well, okay. I want this because everyone now agrees. Both presidential tickets agree.
Everyone agrees
that we should tax tips. But you say
I would say not everyone agrees. I would say Donald Trump stood up in Las Vegas and said, I'm going to arrange for you not to have to pay taxes on tips.
Right.
And Kamala Harris went west yesterday and said, I don't think we should have taxes on tips. And I'm like, what universe are these people living in? First of all, at this moment, let's agree, I think it is the rare server, the rare waiter who reports cash tips and then pays taxes on them. Cash tips go in your wallet. And I think there's a sort of a generally agreed bargain. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to keep track of your cash tips, report them, and pay taxes on them. That doesn't happen. Lots of people, maybe 60, 70, 80% of restaurant meals now are paid with a card of some kind.
Of course.
Even a debit card, the tip is recorded, and then you have to pay taxes on that. Then the restaurateur pays you your tips in your paycheck. Every week,
okay.
Right? The tips that were reported on your checks, and then
why are you trying to shaft these people?
That's income. Why are we suddenly saying we're not going to tax that income? That seems crazy to me. Second of all, we're all, as a nation, God love the servers, exhausted with the tipping culture. If you say we're not going to tax tips, every single place is going to go crazy on tipping. Give me a tip, give me a tip, give me a tip, because I don't have to pay taxes on that income. Here, here's my iPad.
Basically, you are so sick of being asked to pay a tip. I'll be honest.
And
may I ask a question here? If we're not going to tax tips, can that be considered a gift from us? Can we keep track of what we tipped,
can
and therefore
tax
that
deduct? Can yeah. I tax deduct? Yeah, exactly.
I go to Panera occasionally, and here's what the guy does for me. He hands me a cup. That's it.
Right.
And then they turn the little thing around and say, "What kind of tip would you like to do?" And he handed me a cup. I still, like, I do custom tip then. I give them 50 cents. I'm not going to do whatever else, you know, a dollar, because it's normally five, whatever. And I I feel shamed by it. I tip for the cup.
Yeah. Well, also, there is a federal minimum wage for restaurant workers, for workers who typically receive tips.
Okay.
That federal minimum wage is $2.13 an hour. So we don't need to eliminate taxes on tips. What we need to do is eliminate tipping culture and pay restaurant workers a wage, just like we pay clerks at the Gap.
People try that occasionally. People try that occasionally, and they raise the prices, and they don't have the tips, and they say, we pay people. And you know what happens? People don't like it,
people
and people get irritated because all of a sudden the meal is $60. They don't want to confront reality. They want to live with the illusion.
I'll tell you what would irritate me would be buying clothes at the Gap or checking out at Walmart and having those staff members say, how about a tip?
Didn't you just have tips? You were in New Orleans, and there was a 20% tip for the table plus some other tip. What was there?
There was a 4% tip for the kitchen workers with a note that said the entire 4% is divided between the, I am not kidding, very grateful kitchen staff. And what did I say to you? So the check goes up by 24%. I just said, how about we raise the prices 4%, that's $10.50 instead of $10 for an appetizer or a side dish or whatever, and just pay your kitchen workers what you should pay them. Don't tell me you're adding, like, here's your roofing bill. We added 7% for the very happy workers who scaled your roof in the heat to make them happy.
Right.
Just pay the roofers
what they want.
I just find that
amusement
weird.
Parks are having
Here's
a bad summer.
Here's your newspaper story.
All right.
We tipped the writer 25 cents.
Here's an extra 10 cents. Right. Here's an extra 25% for the very grateful writers at the Daily Memphian. Amusement parks having a bad summer. You say why?
Yeah, this is really interesting because we've had many months, many really seasons, years since all these parks reopened of quote unquote experiences. What happened this year is that people gave up the manufactured experiences and went to Italy. They went to Europe. They went to the Grand Canyon. Disney reported that its attendance was stable, but revenue was down 6%. Universal reported a decline in attendance, which it didn't specify, Universal Parks, but 11% decline in revenue this summer. Six Flags, attendance down 6%. So that's really, really interesting. People have had their fill of the amusement parks. Disney, of course, to take a family of four to Disney right now for one day, $450.
So, but I did read that despite this, Disney is investing a vast amount of money in upgrading the parks and in.
Not despite it.
Because of why? And also new cruise ships.
Right.
New cruise ships, too, right?
Complacence. Disney is on Sunday, they had a 3-hour show, very much styled on the way Apple introduces new products, a festival of new products, the most exciting of which is, I thought this was just genius. Disney is going to open a land devoted to villains, a villains theme park called Villains Land at Magic Kingdom in Orlando. That is going to be fun.
Thank you, Charles. On Twitter, @CFishman.
Have a great
over there. Appreciate it. Happy Left Handers Day, Charles. Jeffrey, what is coming up next on 92.9?
Here's what's coming up next.
Jeff, here's what's coming up next on Jason and John. Jessica Benson joins them at 11:25. Tim Murray joins us today on Jeffrey Wright and Company at 2:40. It is Tuesday, so that means Jeff will join Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Back tomorrow for Now Works Done.